Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And I have got an absolutely wonderful episode for you today. I was so thrilled to get the nod from the PR company. And big shout out to Terry for facilitating this, as I'm a huge fan of this band. I got to sit down with They Might Be Giants and specifically John Flansburgh. And it's a great chat. John's a wonderful guy, as you're about to find out. And we just talk about all the records that have been really important in his creative journey to date. And you're in for a real treat. Before we get on with that chat, a few thank yous. So as mentioned, thank you to Terry for facilitating that. Thank you to Scribius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. And thanks to you lot for continuing to support this podcast. You know, send me little messages saying you enjoyed it, retweeting it and liking it and sharing it, all of that stuff. It all helps. It all goes in the pot. Also, if you want to sort of put anything else in the pot, then the way you do that is on my Patreon. And that means that if you go to Patreon, you get access to a back catalogue of another 200 episodes that have never been released to the public. Video episodes, radio shows, all sorts of stuff. And that costs you 79p a month. So it's not too shabby, whatever that works out at, 19p a week. But yeah, it all goes in the pot. And also, if this is your first time listening, when you get to the end of this wonderful chat with John, go explore the back catalogue, because wherever you're listening to this episode on now, go and have a look in the archives on that site, because there'll be 350 episodes with all manner of incredibly interesting creative people, whether that be the Foo Fighters, whether that be Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, whether that be Fatboy Slim, Suede, Idols, James Acaster, Butch Vig, literally, I always rattle off the same 10 names and I've got 350 guests. So the best thing you can do is go and have a little explore, because I'm sure you'll find many, many, many episodes of people. You'll go, oh, I'd be interested to know what the first record he heard that had an emotional impact on him. But you can find out about all of this stuff at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Anyway, I know why you're here, so I can get on with it now. Please enjoy Off the Beat and Track Podcast with John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now. And you may have heard me talking about the products from the Cacao Bar. And there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to. And all you've got to do is, just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we are recording. John, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastically. How are you?
I'm all right. Whereabouts are you today? I mean, I can see where you are. You're in. It looks like a home studio. It looks glorious.
Yeah, I'm in my little project studio. I'm in Sullivan County.
Nice.
Which is 2 hours northwest of New York City. It's like a mountain range, and I'm about. Well, I'm pretty close to where the Woodstock Festival happened.
Oh, lovely.
Which is to say, I'm pretty close to a lot of dairy farms.
Okay. Just before we get on to your playlist today, John, we've just kind of found ourselves coming out of a very bizarre time that I'm sure none of us have ever experienced anything like it previously. I just wonder how the last sort of 16, 17 months of being in a lockdown during a pandemic, how it was for you, both personally and more importantly, creatively as well.
You know, it's been a lot of everything. It's, you know, it's just sort of been and kind of like having this sort of emotional, you know, impossible time. I mean, not to just like be like deathly serious about it, but like at the very beginning of the pandemic, a fellow that we worked with pretty closely years ago, Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne, died, and it was at the exact, you know, it was about 3 weeks into like the lockdown that he passed away. And I think I mean, it was definitely just on an immediate level just very, you know, tragic and sad. And then on a kind of in a more macro way, for us as a group of people in a project, it was very frightening because it just seemed like it was, you know, it was getting very close. You know, the actual crisis was coming very close to us. And, you know, Adam was like a very dynamic, energetic person. And he, you know, he just was a great guy and he was such a life force. And he was the young guy, you know, for us. Like he was 10 years younger than us. So it's like, I think it kind of shook us up in a way to have somebody so close to our world pass away so early on. And it just seemed like it just made me feel like this is going to be way worse than anyone imagines. Yeah. But, you know, since then, I think everybody's kind of gotten used to certain things and gotten over their anxiety and you know, creatively, it's, you know, it's not the greatest thing. I feel like a lot of times I would never have thought I would need to connect with our audience so much for it to feel right. But that's kind of what it is. I mean, a lot of people did a lot of things to kind of get themselves into the world in alternate ways. But I think because John and I were separated and for big intervals of the lockdown, John was actually in Scotland. So like we were just very far away from each other and we just couldn't deal, basically.
Yeah.
It's been a mess.
Okay, well, let's look at more positive things then, and
yes.
let's talk about the joy.
let's talk about an earlier, simpler time.
Well, that's good because this is going to be very retrospective, I'm sure.
Okay. Yes.
I'm going to start your playlist, John. For track one, please, can you tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please?
I know exactly what song I would nominate for having the greatest intro. It's kind of a longer song for a pop single. I have referred to it as being the lunar eclipse under which half of the songs written since then have resided. It's like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, and the intro the song starts with a snare hit. It's just a snare on the four. And it sounds kind of like a gunshot. It's a real shocker kind of intro, but it's really unfussy. And you know exactly what song you're in for after you hear the, it's just the snare hit that was heard around the world. It was an amazing, it's really great drumming.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it, that something is so ingrained in the fabric of music that, like that sort of chime at the beginning of Hard Day's Night, just that snare, just that one single snare, and you know the next 5 minutes, you know what you're getting, and you know it's a glorious ride, and that's just from one drum beat. It's, great shout for an intro,
just but, you know, just on the sidebar, you mentioning the Hard Day's Night thing, I was listening to, this podcast. I don't know how popular it is, but it's interesting to me. It's called something like Shut Up, Let's Just Talk About the Beatles or something like that. And it's just a bunch of LA people talking about the Beatles, and they're just Beatle fans. And they were talking about the recent Paul McCartney interview, and a couple of them were very pro and a couple of them were sort of more skeptical. But one of the musician of the bunch, or one of the musicians in the bunch that was saying that they thought it was sort of unfortunate that Rick Rubin didn't drill down on Paul McCartney to talk about the intro to A Hard Day's Night. They talk about the song, but they never talk about the intro. And there's this whole thing about the intro, which is that there's both a bass note that's not in the guitar chord, and there are notes in a keyboard, I believe. It's unclear how the chord was constructed between the band, because they're not playing. It sounds like just like they're playing like a dominant chord with an unusual voicing. It's like it's a really complex chord. It's like a chord. It's sort of this stacked up, unknowable, unstable harmonic statement. And for people who are kind of into drilling down on the Beatles, they would really like to know how it works. And it's just not known. George Harrison has, people always make fun of Paul McCartney for, making stuff up and gilding the truth a little bit. But, I think it's actually George Harrison has caused more confusion on this point than anybody else, because what he plays is not really the complete chord. But that is a very, very deep musical sidebar. I apologize.
No, the fact that people are talking to Paul McCartney about their song and the intro doesn't get mentioned, I don't think I've ever had a conversation about Hard Day's Night and not referenced how iconic that intro is. It seems very, very...
Right. Well, we will be coming back to A Hard Day's Night later in this interview, so Perfect. Maybe we should move to the next question.
Well, I just want to ask on intros, and obviously you've written a fair few. The way that people listen to music and consume their music, access their music now, is far different from when you was putting records out, when you started out in the mid-80s and such. And I'm watching the way that my children find music on things like TikTok and these apps and things like that. And I'm seeing very short attention spans seem to be kind of quite dominant. And I just wonder, when you guys sit and write, do any of these kind of changes in not technology, but in the way that people listen, does any of that ever filter through into your songwriting and I guess predominantly the intro, because we're seeing with so many pop records now straight in with a chorus, and it's some of these songs are like condensed down to sort of 2 minutes, and it's like it's all killer, no filler on there at all,
right?
Because,
sure,
because kids ain't got time for that anymore, and I just wonder how you view these changes, and do you think there's very much still a place for a traditional kind of approach to songwriting, as per the Beatles and things like that?
Well, sometimes intros don't have that much to say. I think, if you cook up a really interesting intro, that's great. But I personally, I feel like, unfortunately, I am part of the problem. I have a very short attention span, and I enjoy a song that just goes right into it. Yeah. I like songs. Songs that start with like the vocal pickup into the verse is one of my favorite things. And when I was a kid, those songs were considered sort of tricky because the way pop radio was programmed, it meant the DJ couldn't talk over the record. But I always thought those were like the very exciting songs. I like it when you get right into it. And I like shorts. I like short songs. So yeah. I feel like that's just like the legacy of the new wave explosion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then again, I suppose if you go back to rock and roll, when you go back to Motown and things like that, they were all 2.5 minutes of sweet pop music with absolutely no filler as well. So I guess, you know, there's always been a place for that. You know, infectious.
Yeah,
pop.
I mean, there might even you can get pretty far. You can get a lot of repetition of a quick chorus. I think of like the song. There's a song by the Raspberries. It's sort of almost singular. The song "Please Go All the Way" because the verse to the song is only 2 lines long. It's just, you know, the song starts with the vocal, just the vocal by itself, like I was saying. Like, it's like, I didn't know what you wanted to say. It was just taking the da ba da plea. And it's into the chorus. It's like, it's right into the chorus. And it's such pure pop, you know. It's fantastic. And I think they were completely going for just a teeny bop audience. They were just like, forget about, we're not hanging out on anything. We're just going to jump from one little intro line and then it's into the chorus satisfaction.
Wonderful. I'm going to take you back a little bit now, John, and ask you please to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Well, this is a funny choice, but it's kind of true. I grew up in Boston. I had a fake ID as a teenager. When I first was... could learn to drive, I still couldn't go to bars. Like in Massachusetts, is a little bit more conservative than New York traditionally. But I did have a fake ID so I could kind of sneak into bars. And it was not because I was desperate to drink. I didn't drink at all. But I really wanted to see bands. And there were a lot of local bands in the Boston area that were really great in that kind of punk rock new wave moment. I think of like Human Sexual Response, and I saw the Cars second show, and that was like kind of amazing. But there was a band called The Real Kids that were this very sort of street level band. They played at a pizzeria every week, and oftentimes I would go there with my friend Jimmy, and we'd be, you know, there would just be like a couple of other people in the room. Often it seemed like maybe just like their girlfriends and a friend, and we would just watch them play, and it was almost like a paid rehearsal. But there was something, they were also kind of a power pop band really at their core. And they had a very good songwriter, but one of the things that the song that I selected is called Common at Noon. And it's this sort of, cheer up loser kind of song because it's just really melancholy in this very prosaic way. It's just sad in the like kind of like my girl left me way, that but it manages to not be cliche at all, and it is not in any way epic. It's just very small and real and sad, and it really spoke to me.
And what would that emotion have been if you had to sort of pinpoint it, John?
Just loneliness. Just, you know, that loneliness in the abstract, which I think is kind of the way most people experience loneliness. It's you know, anybody who's gone through like a bad breakup, kind of those are ideas that you can always, those are feelings that you can always kind of access. It's just a song about being alone, and it's not you know, I think the fact that it's the Boston Common is like is of just a place that people who have nowhere to go hang out in Boston. It's like, you know, it's definitely like kind of a scrappy place, but it's also just everybody's place, yeah. You know, and everybody just kind of floats through there. And the idea of being there at noon is just, it's just the high, the moment that you're just going to be, it's sort of like this, the song, it's sort of like the same sentiment, opposite approach to like, don't let the sun catch you crying. Yeah. Do you know that song? Which is like everything about it is the kind of the same idea that it's just like we're all kind of stuck in this world, this everyday world, and just because you're feeling terrible, you shouldn't take it too far. But that song is completely Baroque and, you know, kind of heightened.
Yeah.
Common at Noon is just a simple rock song.
Okay.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm going to ask you for track three. Do you want to tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please?
Well, I went to I went on the grand tour of colleges, kind of belly flopping out of one and then another. In the middle of it, I went to a very progressive college, university called Antioch, that's located in Ohio, and they have a work study program where, for 6 months of the year, you're actually working in the world. It was kind of before the whole intern idea had taken hold. So it was like, it seemed more experimental at the time. But I had an internship at this, I was living in Atlanta for 4 or 5 months and working at this place that would become like the Atlanta Independent Film Festival. And I just had this crazy, terrible apartment in the worst part of town. My next door neighbor was a man named Spoon. And my window looked out on this very frightening strip club. And it was just awful. But I had no furniture because I just wasn't going to be there for that long. So I just literally had like a mattress and like a milk crate, but I had a radio, and I would listen to the local college station, and while I was just sort of staring at the ceiling in this furnitureless apartment, for the very first time, with no announcement and no understanding of what I was listening to, I heard Laurie Anderson's "Oh Superman," and it was just such a magnificent UFO kind of landing in my consciousness. I had never heard a song like it. I was already doing home recording, and you know, I had a tape recorder, and I've worked with tape loops, so I kind of had a lot of ideas. I knew how Sound on Sound worked, and I knew how to do overdubs, and that was very familiar stuff to me. But there was something about this, the way the Oh Superman was put together, that was completely unknowable to me. And it just blew my mind. It was just such a singular song. And it's also one of those things where I was alone, so I couldn't turn to somebody and go, like, can you believe this? Like, yeah. What is this? I don't even know if it was back announced. I did put it together very quickly who it was. But yeah, that's the story behind that.
That's the reaction I imagine most people get when they first hear that record. It's like, oh, wow, what's this? Like, because it, you know, sonically it sounds like nothing else. It is like beamed down from outer space. And the fact that, I think the first time I heard that, somebody would have said to me, you need to hear this record. It's out there. And like, to be laying there on your own and just no intro, and then all of a sudden you're subjected to this insane record. It's like, and you're just there with your own thoughts going, what's going on here? Because it's a crackers record, isn't it?
Yeah. Although, I mean, I have to say, like, I moved to New York shortly thereafter, and watching New York cable television, that's pretty much your continuous impression. Watching 15 minutes of anything on public access cable TV in New York City was like, I think I need to tape this just to verify that it is the thing that I think I'm seeing. Or maybe I should just call the cops.
Oh, wonderful. You didn't think when that record come on of giving Spoon a knock on his door to see if he wanted to come over and check out Laurie
Spoon
Anderson?
Spoon came over. He was a crazy guy.
Was school an experience that you enjoyed, John?
I was a really terrible student. I was pretty lost for most of my childhood when it came to academics. But when I moved to New York and went to art school, and which was kind of like the last hope for me, I really found it to be, I was really surprised that it was such a good fit for me. And in fact, it was kind of introduced a level of discipline into my life that I had never had before. And I think it took going to art school, where the discipline you apply to art school is very different than just, you know, regular study. So it was just great. It was a little creative boot camp, and it had a big positive effect on me. I'm really grateful that I got to do it.
Did you get that kind of experience of kind of like finding your tribe and like-minded people when you got to art school?
I wish that was. I had one really good friend, but it was, I came in as a transfer, and that made me, I was much older than everybody. I was 21 and everyone around me was 17. So I sort of felt like I was being sent back.
Yeah.
But, and those 17-year-olds, a lot of them were really not adults at all. So it felt a little bit like I was being punished. But at the same time, it was a huge challenge. I wish I was hanging out. My high school experience, where I met John Linnell, who would be like my musical collaborator for my whole adult life, that whole experience was very social and real. But no, by the time I got to art school, I was kind of on my own.
And by the time you got to art school, was the career path for you within the arts, or was music something that was a big focus of, you know, and did it seem...
I had been in a band. I'm sorry, I just sort of like laughing in this really self-conscious way, because when I was at Antioch in Ohio, I was in a college band with my friend Dan Spock, who I knew in high school, and we were both in this band called the Blackouts, and we played some instrumentals. We played like dance music. It was kind of a dance-oriented band. It was sort of proto-industrial. I think the best comparison would be James Chance or James Black and the Whites, or James White and the Blacks, who were kind of a new no wave band out of New York City at the time. We were aware of that kind of music. Half of our repertoire was just James Brown songs done sort of terribly. But while I was at Antioch, I became known for being like a guy in a band, and it sort of undermined anything serious I was doing academically. Like it made me a non-serious person. And when I came to Pratt, and that's when John and I started Pratt Institute in New York, in Brooklyn, is actually a perfectly legitimate place. I know to British people, the idea of the Pratt Institute is kind of the idea of the institute called Pratt is kind of a joke. I kept the idea of being in a band secret when I was at Pratt. So I didn't tell anybody I was in a band because I just didn't feel like I would be taken seriously as a... It was so important in that school for people to think you were taking your work seriously that I just hid it. And it was odd. But nobody knew I was in a band.
Wow.
I was living a double life.
I mean... Would you change that if you could have gone back? Because being in a band's
no,
kind of cool, right?
I wasn't doing it to be cool in it by any means. I just didn't want to be sort of undermined in the way that I had felt I had experienced. It was a very, art schools can be very self-serious places. And although that wasn't really, I wasn't there for some highfalutin reasons. I just didn't want people to go like, oh, well, you're just a dilettante or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Track 4, the first song you bought from a record store, please, John.
We've talked about it already. I got a check for $5 from my grandmother on my 5th birthday, and my father and I marched down to Leechmere Sales in the suburbs of Boston and bought at full retail price the soundtrack album to A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. And it cost like $1.98 instead of $1.25, which is what soundtrack albums went for instead of like pop albums that were always on sale. And my dad was furious. He thought it was a total ripoff. And then the weird thing is I got the record home and Hard Day's Night by the Beatles is half instrumental, George Martin instrumentals. So it's fully padded. Like they could have put all the Beatles songs on one side and the George Martin instrumentals on the other, but instead they weave the Beatles songs in and out with these George Martin instrumentals. And it was just like an object lesson in what was good and what was bad.
And in the years that followed that, John, how important did record stores become for you?
Oh, I worked in a record store when I was a teenager. I guess the movie High Fidelity kind of captures a certain kind of record store culture. I was not that guy. No, I was not that guy. Although I did do an in-store. Debbie, the Blondie, came in to do an in-store appearance that actually was more like the in-store in Spinal Tap, where nobody showed up. People listening to this podcast probably might have access to Google. If you Google Morris Levy, Morris Levy holds the unique distinction of being one of the only people directly sued by John Lennon. He took songwriting credit for Why Do Fools Fall in Love. He was kind of famously is portrayed in the Sopranos as the Jewish mobster in the music business. He was the guy who owned Strawberries, which was a big chain in Boston. Strawberries bootlegged a lot of records and sold a lot of fake copies of Off the Wall by Michael Jackson. I think their actual connection was through like Jamaican record production that was actually licensed by CBS and Warner Brothers, where they would just like overnight, they would just in the factory, they would just press records over and over again. We would get these records in and half of the records would be returned. An entire box would arrive and they'd all be warped. And it was this weird self-bootlegging thing. It wasn't people stealing the films and it looked just like a legitimate record. it just was pressed under like really, really illegal circumstances.
Yeah.
It was a very strange, pretty criminal enterprise. But that was my record store experience. We had to wear uniforms. It was really jive.
I just want to go back to something that you mentioned. So there was an in-store by Blondie.
I feel like I'm in the middle of This Is Your Life. Like I've done this is like my third interview of the day, and these are all so much infinitely more personal than anything I've talked about with anybody else.
I'm really intrigued that there was an in-store in your record shop that Blondie played at, and nobody arrived.
And I was kind of the only person who really liked new wave music in the store. Like everybody else was kind of classic rock. This is the spring of 1978 or something like that. So they actually kind of stuck me with them to just kind of cheer them up, like because I was definitely a fan. But I don't think it worked. I mean, I think Debbie Harry was just like, you know, who is the stupid kid, you know? But, you know, she was lovely. I mean, she just kind of hung in there. But it was a total dud. They arrived to do this in-store at like 11 o'clock in the morning or something. And it's Harvard Square. It's all people are going to Harvard in the area. So nobody showed up. I mean, they weren't that famous. This was for Plastic Letters, I guess, which is like kind of their first breakthrough. But it was definitely before, you know, Heart of Glass.
Okay. Let's move things forward for track five.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you, please, John, to tell me the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
This song is absolutely the soundtrack to my life from 1984 or 85 to like 87, 88, when They Might Be Giants was playing every third week or fourth week at the Pyramid Club in New York City. The Pyramid was the happening nut spot in the Lower East Side. It had a capacity of 400 people. They would flip the room three times, maybe four times on weekends. So it was just this total, it was just a total scene. There were transvestites dancing on the bar pretty much from all night long. There were a lot of drag acts that would perform. A lot of local bands would play. You'd play very short sets. They didn't want you to play for more than 20 minutes, which was crazy. And a lot of times they just wanted you to play a completely different show the next time, which is also, and they didn't want you to play any covers. So it was very different. It was very creative. And every time we got off stage, this song Dominatrix Sleeps Tonight would be played. And I had no idea why. I mean, I this is a club that I heard a lot of music for the first time. I heard Run DMC for the first time in this club, and that was kind of a revelation. But later on, I found out that the DJ at the Pyramid Club was the producer of the song Dominatrix Sleep Tonight, and he just always took advantage of that moment to slip in his own product. I mean, it's a really catchy song, and it's a very crazy song, and it's a real dance floor filler. I mean, people did love it because it's just so transgressive.
And to be on stage surrounded by, you know, so much kind of glamorous madness, and it sounded like a super exciting time. And other bands, you know, playing, you know, alongside yourselves and that. Two questions I want to ask you. To find yourself in that environment, like, was you confident?
No, I was a child. I mean, I was 24, 25 years old, and almost everybody who ran the club was kind of older, like probably in their early 30s, and it was very druggy. So... and very sophisticated, like sexually. Like while we were sort of a fixture there, Bronski Beat came in from the UK. Dead or Alive came in. I mean, I heard the song "You Spin Me Round" like 2 years before it was, or a year before it was a hit in the US. I mean, I'm sure it was probably a hit in the UK at that time, but it definitely was like a very unusual fresh breeze. So it was just a crazy place. But, you know, we were just kind of, I felt like we were just, I think they liked us because we were kind of innocent in a way. It was a very debauched place.
And to do that and to go on to have the success that you've had in a very, very, you know, tough industry to excel in and have success and maintain success. Are you driven?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, in kind of a more ambient way. I mean, I think, you know, my dad was a workaholic. John and I have like a very strong kind of work ethic. You know, we've got a new album coming out in like in a couple of weeks, and we're already working on the next record, you know, in earnest. I mean, we actually did like a recording session that lasted like a week. It was completely exhausting. And that, you know, that record's not going to come out for another year. Yeah. But it's like, we just know that we should get down to it and kind of do it. It's just, that's kind of who we are.
Excuse me.
I mean, driven is a funny thing to say because it's like, I don't feel like we're particularly ambitious in like the, like we're going to conquer the world. I think it's just more like a pathology. It's just like, it's fun to make music and we feel lucky that we get to. So it's like, we just do it whenever we can.
Yeah. And the output's
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Prolific, you know, you're such active, you know, such an active band. It's that's just made me think, like, you know, I just wondered how, you know, collectively how driven you are.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, compared to some people, you know, I mean, we probably seem ambitious. It's, you know, among my friends, I feel like I you know, probably seem pretty driven, but it's not like it's not that craven.
Yeah. Okay, let's take you home. Track 6, John, a favorite song from an artist from your home county, please.
When I was a teenager in Massachusetts, Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers were actually a local band. They played at like the high school next to where I went to high school. I didn't get to see them. I heard about them. But the song Roadrunner was played pretty regularly on WBCN before it became kind of a more formatted radio station back in the days of like freeform radio. And, the, you know, kind of like the Real Kids song that I noted before, there was something just so, to borrow a drag expression, the realness of the song was really high. I mean, it mentions all these, the song name checks all these suburban places that I drove through as a teenager. So not only was it just a great rockin' song, it was where I was from. And it sort of made me feel like I lived in a place that was rockin'.
Yeah.
And there's nothing less rocking than the suburbs of Boston. You know, I mean, it is just a world of teenagers who feel impossibly trapped. And so the song just seems like this great celebration of being free and driving on the highway, you know, in the suburbs. So it's just a magnificent song.
And talking about like home counties and Boston and such, but before we press record, you mentioned that the band played with the Pixies early on and such. Did it ever feel like that in them kind of early days there was a scene that you was part of in Boston? Did it feel like, and if so, like who else was kind of, you know, involved in that? And do you think that these kind of scenes still exist?
I'm sure they still exist, but you don't identify them. They're subcultural, so you don't know what they are going to turn into except in retrospect. I mean, seeing the Cars second show, my friend Jimmy Mack saw the Cars first show, I think in Framingham at some, it might have actually been at Framingham High School where Jonathan Richman played. The Cars were a band that had been woodshedding for months and months. And so when they came out, they, unlike a lot of punk rock bands of that era, they kind of arrived fully formed. Like, they actually, a lot of times you'd see bands and they would be terrible, and then they'd get better, and then they'd evolve into something really great. I mean, that was kind of like what the Real Kids did. I mean, they just got better and better. The Cars arrived, like, ready, you know, screen ready, as they say, you know. They just had great songs. And in a way, that was, what was even better is that in the club, you couldn't understand the words. Yeah. So the fact that their words were kind of maybe the weak part didn't matter that much. They just looked really cool. They looked like they were from New York. You know, I mean, Boston bands had this very humble street level thing. And the New York bands all were wearing like junk store clothes and just seemed, you know, maybe, you know, just elevated in a way. They were like that, and they were very impressive.
Last track, John, you get to play Tastemaker here, and I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
I love this song so much. It's a new band. I think they only have two songs now on Spotify. I discovered them literally through just casting around on new releases on Spotify. I didn't know anything about them. I don't know where they're from. The band is called Wet Leg, and the song is called Chaise Lounge. And I just think it's two women in the band, and I have no idea how they put their tracks together. It's just a totally rocking song. It kind of reminds me of Iggy Pop a little bit in its freewheeling way. Like, the first part is kind of addressing her parents, and the second part is trying to seduce a man in a nightclub. And I just think it's magnificent.
Yeah, they're blowing up in the UK at the moment. There's
oh great.
There's a lot of attention on them at the moment. Six Music are playing their records to absolute death at the moment. The new track Wet Dream is amazing as well. And
great band.
They're super super exciting. That's a great shout. Okay, well, before we sort of start to wrap things up, as we sort of find ourselves coming to the end of 2021, which let's hope is a far more kind of joyous and connected and freer time than the first part of this year. With that in mind, John, what are you looking forward to personally from the rest of this year, and what's going to be happening professionally?
I'm looking forward to losing an incredible amount of weight.
I think everyone is, mate.
I think it's going to be startling to the people around me how dedicated and focused I'm going to be on that, achieving that goal. You know, we're actually going to be doing shows again next March, and hopefully this Delta variant will be behind us by then, and all the loopy people who are reluctant to get vaccinated will get over themselves and start having some common sense. It's such a crazy time, you know. We're just going to keep on doing the things that we do, and hope the world, you know, keeps in one piece.
Can we expect to see you in the UK?
I believe those shows are those shows booked. I'm not sure. The shows we're doing in March and April in the US, which are pretty much, there's like 45 shows or something, and 40 of them are sold out. So but they've been rescheduled three times.
Yeah.
So I think we just want to make sure everybody's safe. I don't want to be on the cutting edge of anything.
Absolutely.
When it comes to like live performance right now. I would hate to put people in harm's way. And I suspect it will be infinitely better. But right now, I think everybody's just kind of tippy-toeing around, hoping that things are going to work out.
Sure. And if people want to keep up to speed with what's going on with the band, where's the best place to do that, John?
Well, we have a website at theymightbegiants.com, and we have a free music app that's really kind of a delightful little thing that you can install in your smartphone. It goes with Android and with Apple phones, and it's looks like a little cassette made out of felt, and it plays five songs. It changes every day, and it's got unreleased material on it. It's got all sorts of stuff on it, new songs.
And what's the app called?
It's called They Might Be Giants, I think. It's at the App Store. It's at the App Store. We were thinking about calling it Dial-A-Song, just in the same legacy as the Dial-A-Song thing, but you're not dialing anything, and less people know Dial-A-Song than They Might Be Giants, so I think it just got called They Might Be Giants. I actually don't know.
Oh, wonderful. John, it's been an absolute pleasure getting to talk records with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. The pleasure has been entirely mine. This has been delightful. I was not expecting this.
Oh, so happy surprise?
Very happy surprise. Yeah. I mean, many interviews are really like, so where did you get your band name? You know, and you're just like, it's an interesting story I've told 5,000 times.
Well, it's nice to talk about and get excited about other people's records, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's my jam.
Wonderful. John, absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Okay. All right, great. Well, I'm going to hit the leave thing, and then I'm going to hit save. I hope I have your email address.
I think Terry's got it.
Okay, hold on a second. But I might have it here. Is your contact info info@podbiblemag.com?
That's it, yep.
That's it, okay. So I got it. So I'm going to send you this WAV file via WeTransfer right now.
Perfect. Oh, John, that's absolutely great of you. Have a wonderful day, man, and thanks again for this.
Go on. Stu, one last thing. You know, I think you should just cut out the whole first bit. It's such a downer. I was just being real.
I'll tell you, John, if you don't mind, I'd rather not, because I'm a huge, huge Fountains of Wayne fan.
Okay.
And any reason to talk about that?
Fine. I mean, I just was wondering if, like, tonally it was just too, just like, zoinks.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. Okay. If you're cool with that, then.
Yeah, if it feels thoughtful enough, I just, you know, it's just like, it's such a treacherous territory, like talking about, you know, stuff like that. I just don't want to turn anybody off. But if you think it works, then that's
fine. If it means more people go and check out that first Fountains of Wayne album again, then. Let's keep it in there.
I love those.
What I also do as well, John, is I put together a little Spotify playlist of all the tracks that you've chose. And obviously I put some There Might Be Giants records on there as well. And I'll throw some Fountains of Wayne on there as well.
Oh, please do. Yeah, that'd be great.
Wonderful. Excellent. Have a lovely day, John. Thanks again.
Yeah, radiation vibe. All right, I'll talk to you later.
Amazing.
Okay.
See you soon, man.
Adios.
Bye-bye. There you go. John, what an absolutely lovely guy. Had to kind of keep a lid on being a super fanboy there. Hope I didn't embarrass myself too much. What a band. What a lovely guy. Chose some incredible songs and wrapping things up with Wet Leg as well. Solid choice, my friend. Solid choice. As mentioned at the beginning, if that was your first chance to hear Off the Beat and Track podcast, you've got a lot of catching up to do. 350 episodes. Go explore that back catalogue. Go get stuck in, because I have had some chats with some wonderful musicians, actors, DJs, producers, artists, comedians. Go have a rummage, and I guarantee you'll find some episodes that you're going to enjoy. Everything you need to know about this podcast is at the website. It's your one-stop shop, www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I think we're done. Thanks ever so much for listening. Thanks again to my guest, John. Go explore the world of They Might Be Giants if you've never got stuck in, because what a glorious place that is. And I'll be back next time. Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.